I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mike Dover joins me now. The professor and author has written a new book, Dante's Infinite Monkeys, Technology Meets the Seven Deadly Sins. In the book, he looks at how the internet and technology have allowed wrath, lust, gluttony, sloth, pride, envy, and greed to permeate our lives a little bit more, and for some people more so. We all think the internet is a good thing, advancing our technology, but it can also make us susceptible to harm. I'll get Mr. Dover to go through the seven sins and their place in our lives. Mike Dover is the co-author of Wikibrands and led the research that formed the basis of Wikonomics. He is a professor of marketing at Humber College in Toronto and is managing partner of the Social Struct Advisory Group. This new book is published by Humber Press. The website for more is at dantesmonkeys.ca. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Mike Dover. Professor Dover, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the invite.
So what I was wondering about as I was reading your book was throughout the history of mankind, we have had the capacity to fall prey to these seven deadly sins. With the advent of the internet in the last 25 years or so, social media, technology, advancements and the sort, have we been made more easily susceptible to these seven sins?
Well, I think there's two aspects that I looked at in the book. The first, which I expected going in, was that some of these sins are accelerated and accentuated by technology. In other cases, they've changed. So our concept of some of these sins has changed and will continue to change.
Yeah, so like something that has changed is food. I mean, we've always eaten food. We've always admired food that we've seen photographed and the sort. But because of technology, we can take photographs of every meal and share those with everybody and more people than usual. I mean, in the old days, you'd take a photo of a great meal that you'd have on holiday and then show your friends and family when you got back. Now you can share it quickly and with strangers.
Yeah, and in the book I talk about, there's a New York restaurateur who found some old security tapes, and they were from 6 or 7 years ago, and mm-hmm. he watched them. And what he noticed was the absence of people taking pictures of their food, and he compared the times of it took for meal service then to now.
Yeah.
And it's not just people stopping to take food, it's to have the waiter come take a picture of the group,
yeah.
and also even people playing with their phones before they even go into order.
Yeah.
And then given all of that, if even though the customers aren't behaving as properly as they did before, the customers could then go write a nasty Yelp review if they weren't happy or there wasn't enough lighting in the restaurant to get a good picture of the food.
Yeah. I want to talk about wrath in just a sec, but in terms of our relationship to food, have you found that our tastes have changed because of technology? I mean, we're hearing a lot about avocados this week.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's something that, because we're talking about it, has turned people onto it. And you see a spike, say, in the consumption of that product.
Well, I think that certainly food has changed in good ways because we have a lot more information about nutrition. I mean, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have access to lots more food than we would have had before. I mean, I'm in Toronto right now. If you think of cuisine in Toronto when I was a little kid, so like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there really was, you have roast beef, and now you have access to everything. The good thing with food is with molecular technology when it comes to making really, incredible artisan meals are all good. And when it comes to something like gluttony, way back, gluttony was considered to be a sin because you're using up excess food that should go into everybody.
Yeah.
Whereas now, especially in the States, the people who are more likely to be overweight are people who are poor, and they live in a food desert, so they don't have access to fresh vegetables and that type of thing.
Yeah. Now, what about, you mentioned, the nasty Yelp review. The wrath that people have, not only towards businesses, but to each other, bullying, insulting people online, that has changed, hasn't it? I mean, as you say in the book, it's accelerated because of the internet.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, bullying, of course, has always existed. But if you look at bullying where we think about it as kids at school, that used to end at the end of the school day.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, it's 24/7. Well, but it's not just for thought was for kids. I mean, I would not want to be a politician today. All the nasty memes and false dichotomies and false equivalencies, you know, because I wouldn't want to put myself out there where I can be vilified by somebody who thinks it's a clever meme. And I think when it comes to things like online vigilantism, you know, there's no, I have a subtitle in one of the Wrath chapters saying there's no justice like mob justice. And vigilante justice can have a place if the regular system is too corrupt or too ineffective. But there are good parts about vigilante justice and lots of things that are bad for it. So I'm, you know, I think it's good if you have, so America is going to be a detective on something. That's good. If you have lots of people going, let's find the truth about it. But having the mob be the prosecutor and the executioner, you know, there's obviously lots and lots of trouble with that.
But don't you think that's the way we're headed, though, for more of that and an increase in that and in the severity of all that?
Yeah, it is. I think that if we're going to be hopeful, people can fight back against that. People are going to understand how to deal with that better. But reluctant celebrities, so people who say something stupid or say, you know, post something or tweet something and think it's just going to go to their friends, they can be really overpunished, in my opinion. So doxing is where, say, I'm offended by that person, I'm going to post all of their personal information, and they said something I think is racist. They said I think something is homophobic. Everybody phone their boss. Everybody demand that they get fired. Then if people, say something that's insensitive or say something that's stupid or immature, should they be punished forever? And there's, you know, several examples I put in the book of people whose names will always be Googleable for a momentary lapse of judgment or something that was out of context or something that they didn't support properly. I think, if your name happens to be, if your real name is Harry Potter, you know, you could say whatever you want.
Yeah.
And you'll be invisible on Google.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people, a mistake, then that will stay with them forever.
So what part do you think governments have, say, in getting involved? I mean, more regulation, perhaps? I mean, it seems that because technology is moving at such a fast pace, you can't, the laws can't catch up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would entirely agree with that statement. Let's say we are looking at drug enforcement and what is considered to be an illegal drug. Really good chemists can change something. So let's say that you're selling, ecstasy or some sort of party drug. The molecules that goes in that, you say, okay, I can declare this illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's going to take 12 months to go through House of Commons if it's fast-tracked. So what if we change that a little bit? We can still get the high or whatever the desired effect is of the drug, and the new chemical compound doesn't yet violate that. It's very, very difficult to keep up with that. And when it comes to things even like online copyright, that's hard to keep up with.
Mm.
And what's considered to be worth being prosecuted. You know, that's really troubling as well. And it's hard for governments to keep up. Also, of course, because the internet goes across international borders, it's very tricky to say, well, this country is more as thinks the following should be illegal.
Mm.
Should that be illegal everywhere? And it can't be.
Yeah.
And if you look at, like, in Canada here, we're kind of in the middle of societies when it comes to things like morality, when it comes to, erotica. So people in Scandinavia would consider us very prudish.
Mm-hmm.
We would consider people who live in some parts of the Middle East to be very prudish. So what is considered to be appropriate? You know, Japan's an entirely different thing of what's considered to be acceptable there, what's considered to be fun and harmless, which would be, different in different jurisdictions.
So do innovators, inventors, people that come up with this stuff, that develop technology, first of all, do they see the ills to society that they're contributing to?
Sometimes.
Yeah, and so do you think they have a role in terms of well, I don't know, in terms of helping people more?
Yeah, I think so, but that's even tricky about how that gets set up. So if you looked, say, at Mark Zuckerberg, he made his fortune with Facebook. So he's already, you know, has unspendable multi-generational wealth and a lot of power. He now considers himself to be a very important social leader and wants to address what he thinks is important from a societal point of view. But does he really have the right to that? Nobody elected him to do that.
Mm.
He can do things that would be unfair, and he can highlight things that appear on Facebook that he agrees with and delete or diminish things he doesn't agree with. And he might say, well, of course, I'm doing this because I'm taking away the bad part. But really, who is he to decide that? And I think there are many of the people, and there's been a lot written about this. Like, at least Zuckerberg is self-aware, I believe, and is trying to do the right thing. But a lot of these tech billionaires or tech multimillionaires are sort of the self-declared elite who aren't really interested in helping other things out. And they say, well, I deserve this. This wealth I had because I made this incredible app.
Mm-hmm.
There's people are building or talk about seasteading, which is making these artificial islands that are 3 meters in international water outside San Francisco. Because these people have built their fortunes really, you know, based on societies that have helped, that have given them the infrastructure to do that. They say, well, we don't really want any of your rules anymore, so we'll just float out here and take helicopters into San Francisco every day to do our business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How people have changed in terms of their personalities, their morality, and their ethics. Have you noticed a discernible change in that because of the last few years of how technology has advanced, say? I mean, have we devolved in terms of our ethics and morality?
Well, I don't know if we all have. Certainly, what is considered to be private has changed.
Mm.
There's a lot of victim blaming now and sort of people who demand name and shame. That, I think, has changed because it's easy to do now. I think there is some crimes of opportunity where people who wouldn't have been a criminal before have figured out a way that they may think is harmless. And perhaps they wouldn't have. Let's say you're looking at, if you talk to young people, and I teach 20-somethings,
mm-hmm.
very few of them buy textbooks. And it's, you know, they would consider it to be, why would they possibly buy a textbook that's too expensive when they can find the PDF from it online? And I thought, okay, well, don't you consider that stealing? And none of them do. I would not want to be, and I'm not an investor in something like Rogers, because I talk to 20-somethings, and I say, even if you, let's say you got a job for $1 million a year, would you pay for cable? And very few of them would.
Yeah.
Now, I consider... And I'm not a huge fan of Rogers, but I consider that stealing.
Yeah.
I'm an author. I consider people getting my book for free, which is about 48 hours from the time you publish it. It's available somewhere for free. I consider that stealing, but you know many people don't.
Yeah. So if that kind of attitude a difference in how one views stealing is prevalent amongst young people, this 20-somethings of today. What does that mean when they're 30, 40, 50 down the line? I mean, do you think that there'll be a change in how society regards something? I mean, like crime even. I mean, do you think it has an influence there?
Well, they wouldn't consider it a crime. And some people suggest that, well, they're just not paying for cable because they're young. But I have lots of evidence that that's not the case. They just don't consider that something that they should ever pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that is that criminal activity, is that stealing? Many of them say that it isn't. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they would do something else that I might consider to be a crime. But that's just changed. So... people who are selling this need to actually go and make some changes. And we see this with something like ESPN, which made tons of money because every cable package pays a relatively significant percentage of the cable bill goes to ESPN, so they were able to bid up sports properties very high. That is diminishing very, very quickly. And for, it's not just the millennial audience, there's two parts of it. It's not just that they don't want to pay for it. Many of them say, well, I don't want to watch a football game for 3.5 hours. Because I know in that 3.5 hours, there's maybe going to be 45 seconds of really excellent play.
Right.
Someone else will curate that for me and post that on Facebook. So they say, did you see this amazing one-handed catch? That's all I really need to do. So why would I be interested in sitting down and watching something for 3.5 hours?
You know, we know what's bad for us in terms of you know, in day-to-day life, bad food that we shouldn't eat and bad people we shouldn't talk to and apps that consume our lives. Yet we still do. What does that say about us, do you think? I mean, and I guess from my read of your book, I mean, the ubiquity of this technology, that's not going to change anytime soon and probably get worse.
Well, yeah, I know there always will be vice, and I think that will continue to change. Now, let's say somebody is abuses drugs. That's something that could change. Let's say that there was a new version of meth or heroin that provided all of the quote-unquote good parts without any of the negative parts. And you could have a synthetic drug that was created to do this. Will that reduce sort of the viceness of that? And what if you had a drug like that that can be tailored exactly to your DNA that would give you a high 100,000 times better than anything else? That could potentially increase that. Also, you know, a lot of people have been writing about what happens after there's jobs, the post-job society. So if 80% of the people on Earth, we don't need them to work anymore, what will they do with all of that leisure time? And say, well, maybe if we can just put ourselves in a virtual reality world where we are winning the Stanley Cup and we have supermodel girlfriends waiting for us, why would we actually want to come exist into the real world? So some of these bad habits could be changed into a fantasy world that could be, you know, good in some cases.
Yeah, and I guess in a way we're just asking for it because we put so much of ourselves online, whether it's tweet status updates on Facebook, giving our data away, checking into places, you know, telling people we're not home.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just asking for it, aren't we?
Well, I don't know, because it kind of leads to victim blaming,
yeah.
But I absolutely see where you're coming from. There's a wonderful website that's called pleaserobme.com. And it's just a bunch of screenshots of people doing just as you said, saying, oh, yeah, basically, come rob my house because I'm skiing at Whistler. Here's pictures of me skiing at Whistler today. Oh, look, make sure my whole family's there. So the house is absolutely empty.
Yeah. Well, what do you do to safeguard yourself? I mean, people must ask you for advice all the time on what to do with their children and the sort. What do you tell them?
Well, I would say you need to be really careful with what you post online. It's always there. You can't take something back. There was a famous story about somebody who was the ad agency for Chrysler, and they did a tweet of saying, they call it Motor City, but nobody here knows how to, and then an expletive drive. And they thought they were doing that on their personal Twitter, but that was actually on the Chrysler account. So they deleted it right away, but of course it just takes off. You need to be cognizant of what platform you're on. Twitter is very dangerous because Twitter is in no way, unless you have your account locked down, which kind of defeats the purpose.
Right.
But most of the time, that's really out there. Where something maybe on your Facebook, it's more of a walled garden for most people. But still, if you say something on that is offensive, lots of people have lost jobs for that. You could have a vice principal of a school or a teacher for a school that says something that is relatively innocuous for most people, but because of the position they're in, they've been disciplined or fired. When it comes to things like financial information, you need to be, you know, really careful. If something appears to be too good to be true, it probably is. You need to be careful about what to what links to click on.
Yeah.
We just had that ransomware last week, and lots of pretty smart people fell for it. And criminals are getting better and more sophisticated. And you might worry, you think, well, who is possibly falling for these things still? But some people are. Or you could have elder people who lose their faculties a little bit, mm-hmm. who wouldn't have sort of fallen for something before, but may do it now. Also, the more information that you put out, they say, if I was a criminal and I wanted to convince Joseph that I was his friend who needs money to be sent over, because I'm stuck overseas, I've lost my wallet, my passport, I need you to send me money, you're probably not going to fall for that. But if I give you more and more details that I could get because of things you post online, I said, don't you remember that we played hockey together in 1986? Or we went to school, adding more and more details that maybe it's cut from a Skype conversation you and I had last week, or the real me and you had last week, you might then fall for it. So as criminals get more sophisticated, our defenses need to be more sophisticated as well.
What astonishes me sometimes is when I get those, you get them all the time, I'm sure, that these fake emails saying that the CRA has got your refund, or your bank is going to, they want you to deposit some money. So many spelling errors there are, you would think that they would be more sophisticated in that sense, I guess.
You would, and it is baffling that anybody would think that the Canadian government or the IRS in the States would want to be paid an iTunes gift certificate. And it's almost a sense of saying, well, do these people deserve their money? But that's easy for me to say because I have lots of privileges that would prevent me against that. And let's say that you have somebody who came from another country where it made sense that if you were in trouble with the government that you could disappear, your family could disappear.
Yeah.
Or let's say that your tax return last year was a little bit gray, in the gray area. Maybe more likely to fall for that. Or as I mentioned before, if you have somebody who's a senior who never would have fallen for that 2 years ago, you know, maybe they would now.
You mentioned something a moment ago about tweets or posts from the past being dredged up and later on and used against them. We've just come off a provincial election here in British Columbia where in this campaign and in the previous campaign, candidates have had to step aside. Sometimes when it's too late, their names still appear on the ballot because of something that's come up in social media. Do you think... I find that strange because we live in a time where you have an American president who has done grotesque things online and yet, despite all that, has become president of the United States and remains so for the time being. We live in a weird time in terms of our relationship with politicians or people in power and technology.
Yeah, I think the standards for a lot of things have changed. So you remember when Bill Clinton was president, and he was asked on MTV if he ever smoked weed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, but I didn't inhale. And of course he smoked weed, and of course he inhaled. Almost everybody that went to university his age has.
Yeah.
But he felt he needed to hide that because a weed-smoking person can never become president. And you compare that to his predecessors, or his successors, sorry. So W and Obama both say, oh, yeah, sure, we did drugs when we were kids. We both did cocaine. I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't want my kids to do it. So we've changed in not that long a period of time of what would be considered acceptable. And I don't think people who are 20-somethings would be less likely to be judging somebody by what they did in the past to an extent. And I think you and I were lucky that the stupid things that we did when we were younger, it'd be a lot of work to put that online. Somebody have to find an old Polaroid and then scan it and then put it out. Whereas, today it'd be a sort of a higher level. But, if you were running for politics, it's all of that kind of stuff is fair game. I know some comedians, both Tina Fey and Bill Burr, have both said they're not defending jokes anymore. And the joke they're putting out, they put a lot of thought into it. If that offends you, they're sorry in a sense, but they're not going to spend time going to defend it.
Yeah.
And Bill Burr especially said, if you're mad about something that I posted, in 2006, go back in time and yell at me then.
Yeah. But I do wonder, you know, with the coarseness of Donald Trump, does that mean that in the next presidential cycle, candidates can do worse things than he did?
Well, maybe. I think that if he does make it to re-election, you know, hopefully the DNC will come up with somebody who's reasonable against that. It's very, very tricky. And I think that there's lots of examples related to politics around Trump that has brought out the worst in everybody.
But I
don't know. It's hard to be perfect, and especially if you're a politician, and especially a politician in the States, where basically you have 38 to 40% of the people who will vote Republican no matter what, and the same who will vote Democrat no matter what. So you're sort of fighting on people in the middle. Having that much negative, like thousands and thousands of negative posts about the person every day, I think it may drive out good candidates. And keep in mind all of the bad things, that although there are many about Trump, I think that the online vitriol against him may, actually probably will, keep good people who are outside of politics wanting to come into it.
Mm.
And there are, like, and again, we have to put aside all of the many, many flaws we have with Trump, but having somebody who's a successful business person who wants to come in and make changes, there's some good in that. And I think that Washington, or America, really wanted to have a change this cycle. And I'm certainly not the first person to say this, but Hillary Clinton was the wrong person to bring in a anti-insider cycle.
Yeah.
And she said, I think, well, what could be more of an outsider than a woman? Say, well, you.
Yeah.
You know, you are Washington insider. So I think they may have picked the only person that Trump could have beat.
Are you surprised with Trump's tweets that a lot of the, I mean, even just the contradictory stuff, let alone the inflammatory, negative, terribly negative things that he's tweeted over the years, at the end deleted those? I mean, I guess you could go back and get them. That's the point, right? Why bother?
Yeah, I really think that Ivanka or somebody should just take his phone away.
Yeah.
And say, you know, you're just not allowed to do this anymore. But going back and deleting tweets doesn't work. And I think if anybody does a tweet that is in any way provocative, somebody is going to capture that, whether it's on a online backup or just do a screenshot and say, yes, this still exists. And I'm not sure how many followers Trump is up to, but it is over 50 million anyway. And many of those are going to be Trump detractors who will be curating and collecting everything that he says.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult for anybody to not be contradictory with what they've done in the past. And, I mentioned this before, with Twitter, it's hard to have a nuanced argument in that small a period of space.
Yeah. Just imagine the friendships, or the professional or otherwise, that have been destroyed because of conversations on Twitter that have devolved into, well, all kinds of negative banter and name-calling even, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you see that often when you have a social media meltdown.
Yeah.
That it's the wrong person's in charge of it. It might be the middle of the night and having fights going, you know, back and forth. And even if you think of, like, on a Facebook comment page where thousands of people are engaged with it, just the mechanics of it don't work, because whoever's trying to have a fight with 1,000 people can't keep up with all of the different threats.
Yeah.
And sometimes with the very worst thing, I mean, that happened with Applebee's. All of the damage is done 5 hours before the person who's ostensibly in charge wakes up. And by then, many of the people that are trying to get the poor Applebee's person who's having the meltdown, they're going to encourage him or her to have more of a meltdown. Many people do that trolling for sport.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we seem to go, you know, step ahead 2-3 steps, and then, but at the same time, we have to go back. But at the end of the day, I mean, you're still hopeful about us, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to the genesis of this project, I've been studying technology for more than 20 years, and almost all of the projects I've done are saying, here's the good parts of the technology. I'm certainly not a Luddite, I'm not anti-technology, but this is kind of the balance on the other side of saying, well, there's lots and lots of really good stuff, and there continues to be, but there's some dangers and some downsides as well, for sure.
This is our time has just whizzed by. I've greatly enjoyed talking to you, and I've enjoyed reading this book. It's an engaging book, and one that we need to read because there's a lot going on that everything is moving so quickly we may not even realize what's happening, and this is a great chance for us to take a breather, look at ourselves and each other, and think about this. Congratulations on this book, and good luck with it, Mike.
Oh, I really appreciate it.
The book is called Dante's Infinite Monkeys, Technology Meets the Seven Deadly Sins. Humber Press is its publisher. Its author, Mike Dover, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.